Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 11, Episode 11. Ooh, 11-11.
No, please don't. No.
Coming up on this show, Project Pink Koala, the latest Bigfoot fashions, and totally lame time slips. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
See, we're trying to get people excited about the show. And you start with not only that 11-11 crap, but then also you start with totally lame time slips.
They are totally lame. Like, imagine you're about to sit down to a nice breakfast in the morning, and then bam, time slip, you're at work. That's a lame time slip.
Okay, that is pretty much a lame time slip. I'm sure you've got lamer, though, coming up later in the show.
Well, your example was you're about to have sex. And
bam,
then,
you're in the shower.
Bam, yeah, you're smoking a cigarette. Like, damn, lame time slip.
Yeah. Although there's so many stories actually that I've covered this, like I was going through this book of Mothman, which is a new book by, well, it's by John Keel, but it's been edited by Andrew B. Colvin. And of course, because on the last episode, we covered the other book, which is The Great Phonograph in the Sky.
Yes.
But yet again, for some reason, as I've been going through a lot of this work, there seems to be a lot of sticky fluids involved.
Oh, boy.
I don't know why. So talking about lame time slips, it just seems that there's some weird plasma.
Well, bizarrely, the Book of Mothman has about 100 Bigfoot stories in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mothman comes up in like one like small chapter. The rest of it is like all these weird encounters of people being attacked by horrible little beings, people being groped by phantom intruders.
And see, this is one of the new re-releases that's been put together by Andrew Colvin, right?
That's
He's taken all of John Keel's work and re-released it. He had another one I saw just yesterday on this supposedly suppressed manuscript of John Keel's.
Right.
And it was like a diet manual.
A diet manual?
Yeah, it was like...
For what purpose?
John Keel gives advice on how much fiber to eat.
What, to avoid the Men in Black?
Yes. And it's awful. It's like, there's a reason it was a lost manuscript. It's because no one wanted to publish it.
What, so like go vegetarian so you fart more or something to keep them away?
Really, it's like less than 100 pages and it's really awful.
So. Right, okay. So that one won't be coming up on the show.
We're not going to do it on that show. We do have a strange book about UFOs that has a pink koala on the cover.
Let's be honest. The only reason why we decided to do that book was today as we were preparing the session, all I hear you yell out from across the room is, oh my God, UFOs and koalas. Like, what? So,
It's by Preston Nichols. See, first of all, I saw the cover and it's got two flying saucers and then a bright pink koala just going, oh, and you know, looking at the viewer.
Look, I know that they're unusual animals. They're kind of strange. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're extraterrestrial.
Well, as soon as I saw that, I thought we have to do this on the show. But then I saw it was by Preston Nichols.
So re-enlighten us all as to who Preston Nichols is.
Preston Nichols is one of the original Montauk Boys. If you remember, we had Chris Garitano on Season 13, Episode 2, to talk about his documentary project.
Hang on. Is he the fourth field guy?
That's him. Remember, he had an amazing machine that you had to get naked for its full effects, and Chris went to his strange laboratory with all his wacky machines.
I forgot, because there was an element of like perversion that was involved, like the whole getting naked thing. And oh, it all makes sense now. I've just had like one of those weird, like join the dots live on air. Because what you were telling me today is it involves attaching electrodes to a penis.
Well, not directly to the penis.
Oh, well, it's not directly. Okay, well,
the penis is involved. He has another.
You say that so easily.
He has another book called The Music of Time, where he relives being a sound engineer for the Beatles, Mick Jagger, The Doors, The Beach Boys,
The Who,
and everyone else. It's absolutely amazing. But I'm going to get to that pink koala story because that is the cream of the crop. Let's get into some news. Let's talk about some depressing things, because the kind of the way we want to approach the show is the last show with Alex Sakiris was quite serious. So we wanted to, you know, let off a bit of steam on the show.
Yeah, a bit more fun.
And just do some crazy fun stuff. But the first thing in the news isn't really fun. It's quite morbid.
And I are such different people. This is so incredibly exciting. I think this is great.
Oh, I think it's interesting, but it's very morbid. We've spoken
about... We're all going to die, Ben.
We've spoken about everyone's microbiome before, how we have this fingerprint of our internal microorganisms. And there were studies recently that showed if you had simply been in a house for long enough, your microbiome fingerprint would reveal that you had been there.
That's correct.
Unique to you. Well, this article from the BBC is talking about forensic scientists are now looking at not the microbiome, but your necrobiome.
Yeah, well, this actually is almost an extension of entomology, forensic entomology. Now, you may or may not know that when a body is found, I mean, the science of the time of death is actually quite, it's not there. We really can't work out when someone died. So if we find a body that's been lying there for a week, we can kind of work out how long they've been there down to a day or two, but we certainly can't get it anywhere near down to hours. And a lot of that comes from forensic entomology, which really is the insects which have invaded that carcass or that body. Now, we know why someone has been there for a certain period is because when your body starts breaking down, you start releasing gases and scents which attract insects. So the adult insects come along and start laying their larvae and their young inside your body. And then a new group of insects come along because they're then going to feed on the lesser insects. And so you can tell from the generation and type of insects how long you've been there.
But it's not accurate, right? Because you have a 2 or 3 day buffer.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it makes it very difficult. And unfortunately, you know, especially when it comes down to some very difficult cases, that can make a huge difference. So we need something else. So funnily enough, with the development of the microbiome or our understanding, the microbiome's always been there, but our understanding of the microbiome has now moved into forensic science. And the reason why this is so exciting is because it's not only your microbiome, but it also links in with entomology because all those insects that come and lay stuff in you also leave bacteria. So it just leaves another fingerprint upon you, which I'll explain now. So forensic scientists have been trying to harness this necrobiome for quite a while, but they believe that the bugs living upon you and within you could harbor vital clues about the circumstances of your demise and how long you've been dead for. And it's not just the dead that might reveal their secrets through bugs. These microbial fingerprints might actually be used in sexual assault cases to provide police with vital leads about the identity of an assailant.
Yeah, there's an Australian scientist who's looking at the bacteria living on people's pubic hair that could be one of these unique fingerprints. They'll be able to catch rapists this way.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is particularly morbid, so this isn't fun. But one of the biggest issues that has come about in policing in the last, you know, maybe 10 to 15 years or so is actually that a number of perpetrators of sexual assaults and rapes are utilising condoms. Because, like, these shows are taking off where, you know, Law and Order and NCIS and all these other shows, people, the laymen, are beginning to learn, well, maybe that's a way that I can negate forensic science.
Yeah, right.
So the problem is we need other ways to get around. Now, recently, we've discovered that if there's pubic hair, you might be able to analyze that hair. If you're lucky, if there's actually some skin or some of the root left on it, you might be able to get DNA, but it's very rare. The difference is now, with the understanding of the microbiome, we will be able to actually find, analyze the DNA of the bacteria which has hit that person and then match it up to someone.
It's kind of fascinating, this idea that the perpetrator could be at the scene of the crime and yet not leave a finger. Fingerprint, not leave a physical fingerprint, not leave any DNA evidence, not leave a hair and be super careful. But at the same time, if they're there long enough, there might be evidence of their microbiome there.
All you have to do is breathe. That's as simple as it actually comes down to, or if you cough. So it's come to the attention of forensic science in around 2010, where Rob Knight, who works for the University of Boulder in Colorado, discovered that unique bacterial fingerprints could be recovered from people's computers' keyboards. So he went and swabbed their keyboards and found that each person actually had their own fingerprint in regards to the microbes that live in their bodies. And we're beginning to understand the reason for that is that we all have these different bacteria in us, not because of, you know, where we've been or what we've been doing, but it actually comes down to we all have this equilibrium with our immune system. So you and I, Ben, might have some similar bacteria because we're still human beings, but because our immune systems are primed in different ways, we've had different exposure to different pathogens, it means that we'll have slightly different microbial communities inside our bodies, which means that we'll express them in, you know, different ways. But the big thing as well is that if I've been sitting in this office, my microbiome will actually be all over this room. As will yours. So, but gross. The thing is, though, well, it is pretty gross if you think about it, but if you performed an analysis, you would be able to tell the difference between what I've touched and what you have touched.
I like how this field is progressing so quickly as well. I keep seeing so many science headlines, although it's mainstream press, reporting on how much we're learning about how our microbiology affects everything about us. I think I saw a headline the other day talking about how depression might be caused by an imbalance in your internal bacteria.
Yeah, we're only beginning to understand that now, but we have serotonin receptors throughout our stomach, and it's beginning to be believed that certain bacteria can release, basically neurotransmitters, which can affect that, which obviously relay back to the brain and can cause serotonin imbalances and other types of imbalances, which can cause depression. So we're beginning to understand that we are intrinsically linked in our environments to bacteria. And the biggest issue has been recently as well is that if you look on any, network television these days, it's, 99% or kills 99% of bacteria if you use this spray or this wash or whatever. So even recently, for years, I've been using a soap here in Australia, which is called Soapiderm. And the reason why I've been using it is because I have oily skin, and this soap has an ingredient inside it called triclosan. And I've been using it for quite a while because I figured it would kill off all the bacteria, thinking that it would stop me from getting pimples. I've actually learned that you actually kill off all the good bacteria as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Which results in you still getting pimples. But on top of that, new studies have come out suggesting that microbes are actually involved in muscle development as well, because they release different types of chemicals and messengers.
Is this bro science, bro?
This isn't bro science.
Are you going to get max gains by having max bro?
This is peer-reviewed journal research. Okay. Which suggests that by actually utilizing triclosan, which is this antimicrobial agent, can actually cause you to have difficulties in synthesizing the proteins which are associated with muscle development. So we're beginning to understand now that getting rid of bacteria is not a good idea.
This is the same cycle of reasoning that we came to last time we spoke about the microbiome, in that you have to get all the bacteria in you. And the best way to do it, lick your keyboard right now. Just lick that dirty, grimy... But you have an Apple keyboard that has mysteriously gone brown. You need to do something about it.
I'm not going to lick my keyboard. It's disgusting. Yeah, I don't know actually how.
You want max gains, right? You want maximum gains. You need to get that into your body.
It doesn't work that way. You don't have to get all the microbes into you. You just have to have a balance with your environment.
Like, I don't know, bro.
We're not doing any more bro science. It doesn't end well.
Well, speaking of microbiomes, there's one man in the UK from Cumbria who's definitely against other people's biomes. This could also be a misophonia story. He just hates the sound of people sneezing so much. Apparently, there's this guy on the loose. Cumbria police in the UK are looking for him. He's been exhibiting some very unusual behaviour, they say. He's been smacking people in public for sneezing. So there's a couple of cases. One woman got her head belted because she just randomly sneezed last Monday in Carlisle. And there was another attack, well, they're calling it an attack, on a frail pensioner who just happened to sneeze.
Oh, that's below the belt.
And this guy just clobbered them in the back of the head.
Yeah, that's bad. Look, there's no excuse for laying your hands on anyone at all. That's terrible. But you know what? The article doesn't actually say. I mean, did they sneeze without covering their mouths?
Maybe he's being gang-stalked.
Not gang-stalked is the actual, weirdo pronunciation for it. But I don't know. I mean, they're not saying yet. I mean, if they didn't cover their noses, well, then I can understand that. Give someone a whack across the back of the head.
Can a sneeze be an insult?
Well, maybe.
Because you can't really sneeze on command.
No, of course you can't.
So can it really be considered an insult? It's a mistake. I mean, it can be a rude sneeze.
But you can sneeze in someone's face. If it's coming on, you can't do it on purpose.
You know what? When we were in Japan, no one sneezed. Not once.
No. Isn't that bizarre?
One sneezes. No, just, no. They just don't do it.
Well, they do, but they obviously found a way.
Don't do it.
Well, they just don't sneeze at all. That entire element of human biology has been removed.
No Japanese person anywhere ever in the entire history of the planet has ever sneezed.
Then why the hell did I get a flu?
That was from the freaking Australian snowboarders. You know this.
Oh, God, I hate it. You know, I embarrassed myself last night sitting at a family dinner, sitting there with my cousin-in-law who's just come back from Whistler of all locations. And, of course, I didn't even put two and two together. I'm sitting there. I'm like, oh, we got a new group of people we hate, Australian snowboarders. He's like, I snowboard. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, lots of people snowboard.
I'm like, awkward silence for a while.
They're all awful. So the serial sneeze slapper is still on the loose. Next, we head to some psychology news from SciBlog. This is spring.org.uk. And it's a great new study that's been published in the journal Psychological Science just recently. And it's about how people supposedly reach the peak of their mental powers at different ages for different skills. Now, in the past, we used to think that when you reach the age of 19, that's your peak I guess, processing power for your brain.
God, I hope not, because I was a moron at 19.
It's all downhill after that. In terms of raw processing speed,
right,
after you're the
so
age
your
of 19.
So your core i7, that's what you're going to hit when you're sitting at 19, and it's all down to, you know, like a mobile end processor.
Yeah, you're just getting downclocked after that. So apparently this new study throws all that thinking out the window. People think fastest at around 18 years old, but the ability to read emotions of others doesn't peak until about 40 or 60.
Isn't that scary?
Vocabulary skills, meanwhile, do not peak until people are in their 60s or 70s.
Oh, why would you talk about that in such a perfunctory manner, Ben?
God, you're awful. Well, I said to you today, imagine what Mysterious Universe episode 10,017 will be like.
We're going to be like Gore Vidal.
There's a quote from Dr. Joshua Hartston, the study's co-author, who said, at any given age, you're getting better at some things, you're getting worse at some other things, and you're at a plateau at some other things. There's probably not one age at which you're a peak on most things, much less all of them.
You know what this is? This is psychological and neurological RPG character selection. That's all it is.
Yeah, you got a certain amount of points to put in when you're 19, and you've got to distribute some when you're 50 and 60.
Yeah, you balance it out, and as you get a little bit older, some things will go up, other things will go down.
In terms of your memory, your working memory peaks at around 25, and the working memory for numbers peaks at the age of 35.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they did this study based on the data from 50,000 people across a wide age range. The results showed that the brain's raw processing speed, as I said, peaks at 18 and 19, but you know, things like short-term memory peak when you're 25. It's all over the board.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because often, you know, 18 and 19-year-olds, and I was one myself, tend to be impulsive, tend to make rash decisions, tend to be, you know, sometimes a little bit more aggressive in the way that their stances are, but they're also more restricted by their views as well. So I wonder if that's simply you've got all that raw processing power, but you don't have any experience to utilize it with yet. I mean, you'd have a certain level of experience.
Well, this really paints a different picture of how we should view
the elderly.
The power of the brain over someone's lifespan.
That's
and
a good point.
I was thinking about it in terms of the interview we had with Alex last Thursday, and we always think that when people grow older, they get wiser. And wisdom isn't necessarily associated with how fast you are, the raw processing power of your brain. Wisdom comes from something a little bit deeper, I think.
Well,
and maybe that's the case of the brain. It's slowing down in some things, and maybe it's allowing some other knowledge to come through a little bit easier.
Well, I guess that's actually a really good point, because whenever you think about, you know, making a difficult decision, for example, where wisdom comes into play, or where you would see someone as being, or making a wise decision, they ponder it. They take longer, whereas with a younger person, generally, they kind of will just, you know, come up with something very rapidly and very quickly. So maybe you're right. It's not necessarily about having that raw processing power and being as fast as you can. It's about having those different abilities come online at different times and how that actually affects you throughout your life. So, you know, they always say as well, I mean, like certain people of certain ages make better managers, but, you know, we don't necessarily know that. Maybe we'll begin to understand that your ability to be a manager of people will peak between 35 and 50. And then after that, maybe you're better suited for a different role, or, you know what I mean? These things will actually change as we have a greater understanding of psychology and neuroscience.
If your vocabulary is mastered at the age of 60 and 70, why isn't there any 60 and 70 year old rappers killing it right now?
There's
why isn't Flavor Flav?
What's that Nana DJ? Do you remember her? Have you seen her?
What are you talking about?
There's like this old lady DJ who's actually really cool.
I'm sorry, but a DJ isn't a rapper.
Well, no, but she does rap. She's been doing some rapping.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember her name, but yeah, she's just like, yeah, she's doing some rapping.
Well, that answers my question. The greatest rapper on the planet is some random granny DJ that you just thought of.
I didn't think of her. I have to find her.
We'll link to her in the show notes. We've got a lot more coming up after this, including the wild tales of Preston Nichols. Stay with us. Now, as we said at the start of the show, we were looking through books to research and we came across this insane cover that had two flying saucers on it and a freaking glowing pink koala bear.
Yeah, you can't turn it down. You can't.
Immediately, we thought we have to do this for the show. It's Encounter in the Pleiades, an inside look at the UFOs by none other than Preston B. Nichols.
Right, and we know him from somewhere else.
Well, we had Chris Garitano on the second episode of this season to talk about his excellent documentary, The Montauk Chronicles. And in our Plus extension, he did this especially funny impersonation of Preston and related him to Curly from The Three Stooges. I'll just play about a minute of that discussion.
Preston was, it was hilarious. John, the guy I was with at the time, was Mr. True Believer. So he was ready to believe any little thing anyone was going to tell him. And so Preston said, and I always, when I imitate Preston, I kind of sound like Curly the Stooge a little bit because that's who he reminded me of. Yeah. So he was like, come on outside and see the force field.
And,
like,
and did
and so
you?
He goes across to another house that's on the property, and I'm going to go hit the lever. And he goes to hit the lever, and he comes outside, and he's like, do you see it? It's all around us. And I'm like, I don't see anything. And John's like, I think I see it. It's up there. It's blurry above the trees. And I'm like, John, you see nothing. Now, I have all of this on tape, this whole thing. And Preston's like, it's all around us. You can't see it. It's a force field. I'm like, what does a force field look like? It's all over the place. And this went on and on. You know, we were inside at the healing machine. And yeah. He was asking everyone to get naked.
I love how he does the Curly voice. So
force field. He's obviously spent a lot of time with him.
So I had high expectations for wackiness going into this book. And yeah. Preston delivered. Now, it's strange in the way this is written because it's split 50-50. Preston Nichols writes the first half, and then Peter Moon writes the second half. Moon is kind of like the actual writer. He's the ghost writer for Preston Nichols.
Because you were saying that when you were reading it earlier today, that some of the earlier chapters are almost childlike in the way that they've been written.
Well, the way that Preston writes is
very reductive.
Yeah, it's very short sentences. His vocabulary is quite small. Mm. When it comes to technical things or seemingly technical things, he can write page after page.
Right.
But when he's describing experiences and memories, it's very strange the way it's written out.
Look, I'm not saying I believe what he claims, but if he was messed up as a kid with that project, you can kind of understand why he wouldn't have a very good education now.
Well, if you think back to the Montauk project, he claims that he was experimented on, he was used in mind control experiments.
His memory was erased.
Yeah, his memory was erased, and then decades later, all these memories started to come to the forefront of his mind. Things like UFO sightings before he was even in his teens. And he even described that the very earliest memory he had was his bedroom door sliding open at night and this strange, tall, Caucasian man peering around the corner of his bedroom door.
With long blonde hair, right?
Yeah, he said he had white skin and long white blonde hair and he had a glow about him. And remember, the book is called Encounter in the Pleiades.
Right, so Pleiadians.
I'm just going to skip ahead and give you an example of how he lays this out. He says, at about the age of 15, I was transported on a spaceship to a small base located on one of the moons of Jupiter. I believe it was Europa. There I was examined and put through a lot of testing.
Full stop.
There were no bad memories from the experience.
Full stop.
In fact, they were quite good.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Wow.
See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to have to try and spice this up for you a little bit.
Yeah.
He said, I even remember eating like a king. I was also shown their forms of entertainment, which were very similar to ours. They include movies and video games. It's just like...
This gets better, right?
Going to a Pleiadian planet is just like visiting Pittsburgh or something. It's nothing...
But it's basically like a kid that's been on a plane for the first time. And we got on the plane and they gave us food.
Yeah, he said, I was then put on a ship again for a ride that lasted what I thought to be about an Earth day. I soon stepped into a very lush, green and beautiful world they called Alderaan.
Alderaan as in Alderaan?
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, as I'm explaining this story, listen out for the Star Wars references because they come thick and fast.
No.
Of course, he's on an alien planet, so you would expect the description of the alien buildings and the technology to be incredibly advanced.
Crystalline and green and alien and beautiful.
Just different.
Yes.
He says the buildings were a rectilinear type construction similar to ours, except the corners were rounded.
Though art deco.
Again, it's just like Pittsburgh, but all the buildings have rounded corners.
Come on, is he just not some slightly retarded kid who's wandered into the wrong neighborhood?
Well, he's definitely not retarded in the Pleiades, because from the tour of the city, he said, I was taken to what was called an education center. There, I was put through a process which they said gave me the equivalent of 4 different doctorate degrees on Earth.
Hang on. They gave him Palladian honorary doctorates.
Yeah. So it's like, where did you get your qualifications? Well, in the Pleiades.
Oh, it's not even accredited university.
He said they got rid of the neurological problems he had suffered from, which would explain why the awkwardness in my own life, he said, disappeared practically overnight.
Hang on. All kids are awkward. They're kids.
But he's still awkward. I don't know why he thinks...
Yeah, has it gone?
If you've seen the documentaries that he's in,
yeah,
he can only get a few words in because every time he speaks, it's... Yeah. Pretty cringy. He said, obviously, I was very pleased with my newfound friends in the Pleiades. Full stop.
I wish people could see my face right now.
When he starts talking about the history of planet Earth, this is where I was on the edge of my seat until it started to get blatantly racist.
What?
I won't read everything he said, but he goes on to say that the Pleiadians essentially seeded the white race here on planet Earth.
Mm.
And then the Greys came along and they made what he calls the Orientals. And he says you can tell because the Orientals have slanted eyes like the Greys.
Oh, my God.
And have a worker bee mentality.
What a terrible derivative way of looking at evolution.
It gets worse. It gets much worse. So apparently,
I don't know.
The black race came along because the original white race just genetically engineered them.
What?
So, sorry, black folks. And
let's just skip over that. That's a bit nuts.
It gets worse for the Jews.
Oh, no.
The reptilians, he said, from Orion took the Pleiadian seed race and modified them to create the Semitic race.
For what purpose? Why am I even asking?
In addition to the above races, there's also the Native Americans, but he clears that up and says, look, they're not from the Pleiades, they're from Andromeda, so we'll just put them in that little bracket over there.
Jesus Christ.
It's pretty bad. They made Jesus Christ as well.
Good.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh.
But talking about the different factions in the galaxy.
And there's a turf war going on.
They come on planet Earth and they control us. So there's the Neverons. There's the Galactic Confederation and there's the Leverons.
The Neverons and the Leverons. He's not very creative with the stuff he comes up with, is he?
The Neverons are the Pleiadians and they have this very strict non-interference policy. They just will not get involved. The Galactic Confederation...
They're the snow monkeys of the universe.
Yeah, the Galactic Confederation is kind of like what you'd see in Star Trek or Star Wars. They just... It's this alliance.
Right.
But they will interfere if they need to. They're not as strict as just the Pleiadians. And then you have the Leverons, which are just... The badass Sith of the universe. Like, they are controlling the governments on Earth. They've got the Dracos, the Reptilians, the Greys. All the badass aliens are with the Leverons.
Right.
That's their alliance.
So
And their leader is from a planet called Draco, and he wears a cape.
Paranormal fashion.
So let me skip ahead to where he starts to talk about this idea that life on Earth itself hasn't been allowed to evolve on its own terms.
There's always we've heard from other UFO literature.
Yes, there's always been some interference and meddling. And he says, this brings us to the most sinister way to subjugate the population of Earth, abduction and implants. When he starts talking about implants, it gets absolutely insane.
This is where the penis pops up, forgive the pun. Yeah,
no, guano pops out. Yeah. He says a particularly effective technique they will employ to literally electrically stimulate the person to the height of sexuality. So he's talking about his experience with physical programming, because he claims that not only do the Greys abduct people physically, but the secret government abducts people physically and then performs mind control experiments on them.
Associated with the Greys or just separately? They're just abducting people for the hell of it as well.
According to him, they were watching what the Greys were doing and then they thought,
hey,
that kind of works.
Yeah.
And then they started to do it to us as well.
Right.
So again, there's this effective technique where you stimulate the person to the height of sexuality. He says once the subject is excited to the highest point, like just before ejaculation in the male and before an orgasm
in the female
vagina walls, they suspend that state so that the person's consciousness and physicality is suspended in an orgasmic state. He says the mind is in suspension and is technically quite wide open. At that point, all they have to do is pick up a block of memory and put it in. The technology has been developed to where almost any agent can do it. The electroshocking of the person is computer run, and the program is put on a 3.5-inch floppy disk, which is then placed into a portable computer.
What? No USB-C?
So they hook you up. So you're just about to come, and they then suspend you in this state, hook you up.
Cruel.
Hook you up to their 1983 laptop, put a floppy disk in, and then they upload this. Because the floppy disk contains your mind control software on it. So then they upload this to your mind.
I'm never going to be able to hear that Apple startup noise and think of the same thing ever again.
So the way this works is once you have this software running in your mind, once you've been mind controlled.
From a 1.4 megabyte floppy disk.
Yes, that's all you
which
need.
Which I haven't seen a floppy disk since maybe the early 2000s.
It's not that much code. So once you've been programmed with this, you can then transmit that information to anyone else through sexual intercourse.
What? It's like a sexually transmitted virus?
So he goes into very graphic detail by describing that some young men are programmed to such a degree that they can miraculously arouse tremendous desire in women. If the programmers want a program spread around, such young men sow their seed around with the programming of the women concerned being the target.
So this is mind control herpes, basically.
Yes. In this manner, an idea or program can be inserted into the society on a wholesale basis. It could be as simple a program as buy ABC detergent, vote for this politician, or it could be something more complex. So you seed this into, you know, like the guy
you go to a college and you just, you know, abduct a whole heap of kids.
Yeah. In some of these men, he says the magnetism is working overtime to where they can copulate two or three times a day, sometimes with more than one woman. These men are like incubuses and can have quite a devastating, even if romantic, effect on females. My estimate is that about 10% of the male population under 30 have been programmed in this manner.
What?
10%. 10% of the males under 30 have this software running in their mind, and every time they're copulating, it's being spread throughout society.
So can I ask, does safe sex at a condom prevent its spread?
I have no idea.
So because if he's saying it's sexually transmitted, well then how do you transmit that? Is it in biological fluid? Or why am I even asking? What am I doing?
Yeah, see, you always fall into this trap.
I know. I'm looking for X.
Trying to poke holes in what is essentially already
Swiss
cheese.
Yeah.
So going on to implants, because he says the Greys perform implants, they give abductees implants, and so do the NWO abductors as well. Mm-hmm. And Preston himself is very, very good at discovering these implants. So he found that a lot of abductees would approach him and ask for advice about their implants. Now, he has this great example of a biological implant from an abductee that came to light when a fellow from Brooklyn visited him and wanted to be scanned. Now, he says, at that particular time, I was using spectrum analyzers, grid dip oscillators, and other equipment in order to find implants with radio circuitry in them. As I moved an RF radio frequency probe over his body, I noticed a signal appeared when I brought it close to his abdomen. If I took the probe away from his abdomen, the signal went down and almost disappeared on the spectrum analyzer.
So he's holding a pocket radio over this guy's stomach.
I love this scene where there's some random guy probably told to strip naked in Preston's apartment. And he's like, woo, 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 just running this thing over him. He said, I then put the signal into an analyzer so that it could be matched up with the signal being transmitted through this guy's body and identified. So he hooks this guy up to all this machinery. He gets electrodes and he hooks it up to his abdomen where he's getting this signal. And he finds out that this carrier frequency is identical to the TV frequency used by Channel 25 in Brooklyn. It's exactly the same frequency.
So what? Is he suggesting that they're using that to broadcast something?
Well, Preston's like, oh my God, this is amazing that they're using this same frequency as one of my favorite television stations. Why don't I hook this abductee up to my television monitor? So he hooks this guy up. I don't know how he does it. Imagine you're this abductee naked in Preston's apartment. He's like, wait, I'll just hook you up to my television. Let me pull this lever. So he hooks this guy up.
Where's the remote?
Yeah, Clink turns his old TV on. He's like, oh my God, it's Channel 25. Channel 25 shows up on the television screen.
I hate to be the voice of reason, but could it just be because he said that was his favorite channel that he just left it on that channel when he turned the TV back on?
He said, after I thought about this for a while, I realized that someone had set up this ingenious system. They were actually piggybacking their implant transmissions on Channel 25. If anyone were to get close to him with a radio sniffer and pick up the signal, they would automatically assume it's just Channel 25 and think nothing of it.
Oh, well, it all makes sense.
You know, he spends most of his time in New York where they broadcast that station. So it's genius.
It's genius. Okay. All right. I'm beginning to see the madness and the genius coming together.
Now, if you thought Preston's half of the book is insane, wait till you hear what Peter Moon's got to say.
You can get more insane than that.
Well, again, the second half of the book is all Peter Moon describing his early experiences. And he's got some crazy, you know, childhood experience as well. UFO sightings, claimed abductions, out-of-body states. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. We've covered plenty of those stories on the show before.
Yeah.
But then he just starts touting the amazing thing that is Scientology.
Oh.
Chapters and chapters just talking about how misunderstood Scientology is, how awesome it is, how he's, you know, buddies with Hubbard, how Hubbard would use this technique to send you out of body. And eventually he had this time slip experience where Hubbard kind of, he claims Hubbard did this thing where he would sneak up behind you and you wouldn't know he was there and he would just throw you out of your body.
Right.
He would send you into this astral state, and that was his thing. That was his prank.
What a dick thing to do.
That was his prank. So Hubbard did this to him, and he had missing time. And so he always wanted to figure out what this missing time experience was about. And this is where it gets absolutely insane and explains the pink koala on the cover.
Oh, okay.
So he said, a clue of my missing time came from my friend Maya, who channels Tahuti and whose work has paralleled mine in many aspects.
Hang on, Tahuti, the like Egyptian...
Yeah, the Egyptian god.
Yeah.
She told me about a project named Koala, which exists in the future in 8885 AD. I'll just let that sink in for a second.
Ow.
Koala was established by the Inner Light Network in our current time frame and was projected through a time tunnel to the near future. The Inner Light Network is defined as people of Earth who are working for divine order in government and other arenas, many of whom receive direct guidance from ultra-terrestrials. Koala operates on two main levels. The first is human health and ecology to benefit our current time zone. The second is to devise a code germ to be entered into the matrix which the extraterrestrials and the One World League, codenamed OWL, have created to manipulate our time grid via such projects as Montauk. This germ, if successful, would disrupt the gridlock and allow the Metatron to be restored to our reality.
And by the way, koalas and ecology, I mean, those filthy things are spreading chlamydia. You know, like they're filthy, filthy creatures.
Koalas is a horrible thing.
They're terrible.
Why tourists want to touch them.
They grunt and they pee on you.
Smell like piss.
Yes.
They're constantly stoned. And have you ever heard a koala? They're just like,
Yes, I have.
Scream at you. They've got massive talons. They'll scratch your face off. Yes. Koalas are disgusting creatures.
And they've got chlamydia.
No one's naming their secret project, even if it is from 10,000 years in the future, after a shitty animal like a koala.
They're actually not, they're not that bad. They're not terrible. Like, they're okay.
But koalas so he's like, in the end, he's like, well, that's why there's a koala on the front and it's painted by my amazing wife who brought everything to life.
This guy, you know what? There's actually, I'm going to be very calm and collected about this. There is a very technical psychological term for these guys. It's called batshit.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah. So that's a bit of fun, that book. But it doesn't get truly interesting until you go into the music of time. Now, this is where... Again, Preston has all these memories that have resurfaced because of the tortures that were done to him at Montauk, allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah.
And some of the memories that also surfaced was the fact that he was... Well, let me just read it from the book. This is from the intro in the book. Carved into the annals of rock and roll history is an enigmatic and legendary sound engineer who was affectionately known in the music industry as Little Buddha. Loved by musicians and producers for his mysterious and uncanny knack to produce hit after hit record, Little Buddha's identity has remained a virtual secret until now, as Preston Nichols comes forward and reveals his hidden role in the recording industry.
No, if anything, he's responsible for Yoko Ono, and that's it.
Heralded as one of the few people in the world who understands the true physics of time, Preston Nichols explains how subliminals and mind control were used to influence the masses who listened to rock and roll. So let me put this in a nutshell for you. He's claiming that memories have surfaced that he was instrumental in the recordings of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
He helped invent Phil Spector's studio.
You mean the wall of sound technique?
Yeah, let me explain the story. So apparently Phil was looking for someone to help with technical problems in the studio. And of course, Phil Spector, if you don't know who he is, he's a legend in music production, starting from the 60s and onwards, just hit after hit after hit after hit.
He is, but something went wrong somewhere because he's also a vicious, murderous pervert who is now in prison for shooting a woman he brought back to his home.
Oh yeah, I forgot about all that.
Yeah, there's all that stuff as well.
So Preston turns up to this job interview with Phil Spector and Phil's like, I need someone to rebuild the studio. Do you know anything about electronics? And Preston's like, certainly. And he goes and Preston's like, what do you want me to do with a studio? And this is Studio A, you know, Phil's big studio. And apparently Spector said to Preston, I don't care what you do, do whatever you like. So Preston said that was all he said. So I did do whatever I felt like. I spent about 3 months part-time rebuilding this facility. Finally, it was beautiful and brand new. And Phil calls in his audio engineers to start bouncing some tracks. And the audio engineers are like, we don't understand any of this equipment now. Like, whoever this kid is, he's put weird connections and rigged the equipment up in a strange way. We don't understand how anything works. So Phil Spector's like, well, we need to get someone in here who understands what this kid's done. Let's get this kid in. He's claiming that this time he was 16 years old.
Oh, as if, come on.
And because he had rebuilt the studio in this crazy way, he was the only person who knew how to operate it. So that's why they got him in to help, you know, run the production for the Rolling Stone, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Bee Gees, the Mamas and the Papas, Jim Morrison. And throughout this book is all these crazy tales of him being an engineer with like Mick Jagger. And apparently all the people he works with, they're all into psi and the occult.
Oh, like, of course they
he
are.
He takes Mick Jagger home and Mick Jagger does like a Ouija board reading with him. It's, you know, all these crazy tales. And throughout the book, the way that he name drops is amazing because he's like, one of my childhood friends, did I mention he was Mark Hamill from Star Wars? And then later he's like, well, I was doing this thing with my friend Mark Hamill from Star Wars.
Oh.
And then a few chapters later, did I mention Mark Hamill from Star Wars and I were childhood friends? And he claims that he did all this music work with Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill's a musician? Maybe that's very ignorant of me.
Here's what he claims. He did this music work with Mark Hamill and Mark Hamill's older brother, Chuck Hamill. And they produced all these records in the late 60s. And if you look up any information on Mark Hamill's family and history, A, he doesn't have an older brother named Chuck. And B, there's no mention of any of this, you know, work records or music at all. It just doesn't exist.
Do you know what's terrifying is I've actually gone through the reviews of this book. The top review is too factual to be fiction. There's plenty of technical hints here concerning radionics. These diverse subjects have been eloquently woven into the phenomena of music in a very entertaining and spellbinding book. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Well, it gets to the point where he's like, I was done with Spector. We had an argument and I walked out. And then again,
yeah, Spector tried to shoot him.
Hanging out with my childhood friend, Mark Hamill.
Did I mention Mark Hamill?
And Mark Hamill mentioned he was working on this project, Star Wars. And then all of a sudden I got a call from George Lucas. And next thing you know, I was like, slightly. And I was working on this film called Star Wars, doing audio production.
Oh.
Eventually he claims that he invented THX.
THX, as in the sound.
Yeah, the sound
what?
THX.
I think the sound THX technology had something to do with that.
He totally invented that. And when he first tried to demonstrate it to Lucas, it didn't work properly, and Lucas fired him and then hired him back. But some of his experiments into, because it's about this time that he claims that he was being experimented on in Montauk, and he was having psi experiments done on him. And this crossed over into his music production. So he claims that during the production, he figured out that if he stared at the tape head as it was recording the final mix, he could subliminally insert a suggestion or a thought form into the music, and that would affect people. And he claims he was doing this, and this is why the records were selling so well. All these rock and roll records that were produced by Spector and, you know, subsequently influenced by Preston Nichols, they were selling because they were subliminally telling people to go out and buy them. That's what he claims.
Could it just be that people like music?
No, that's absurd. The idea that the Rolling Stones were amazing and no.
Oh.
It's all subliminal.
Right.
So he told Spector about this. He said, look, I'm putting an influence on each of these records that people go out and buy them. And Spector didn't want to have a word of it. He's like, I don't believe you. This is nonsense. You're an amazing engineer, but you're full of shit. I don't believe you. Preston said, let me show you how this works. So what he would do is he would do the mix. And as it was bouncing, he would stare at the tape head and send his thoughts out. But this time he said to Spector, look, I'm going to give a subliminal phone number on this next record. And they worked out the phone number between them and they had a line set up with this phone number. So he stares at this bouncing process on the tape, on the master, and he subliminally puts this phone number into the recording. Now, it's not in the song. It's not mentioned at all. It's not like Mick Jagger spells out the number. It's subliminal.
Yeah, you can't actually hear it, right?
Now, as the record is released, about a week after the record's released, they start getting thousands and thousands and thousands of calls to this phone number they set up.
According, though, to Preston Nichols.
Now, he doesn't mention what this record is at all. He does mention, however, that he was responsible for the song Big Girls Don't Cry.
By Richie Valens.
Frankie Valli. Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And if you listen to the end of the record, you can actually hear him singing Big Girls Don't Cry.
Oh, my God. Do you have it? Can we hear it?
Of course I have it.
All right. Play it.
Big girls don't cry. Big girls don't cry. Big girls.
Did you hear him?
Is that him?
He was like, whoa, 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 whoa.
No, you can actually hear at one point there that another person is singing, but it's obviously not him.
That's Preston Nichols. It's Preston Nichols. So he claims that eventually his controllers at Montauk were getting him to insert political things into these rock and roll records and who to vote for and, you know, what to do in society and what to buy and what to do. It was this mass mind control experiment and they were using Nichols as this conduit because he was the greatest engineer that was producing all these hits.
You know, it hasn't changed though, has it? Like this madness that our society is being manipulated by big music and this kind of stuff. Like it's just nuts,
Ben. It's funny reading through this. A lot of the conspiracy theories that you read from these so-called super soldiers today, they've gotten a lot of the stuff from the ramblings of Nichols.
Yeah, it builds upon itself.
Yeah, a lot of it's just come from what he's talking about in these early books.
This is why, though, it's actually quite dangerous, Ben, because it actually becomes reinforcing. It becomes legend within those communities, and so people start to actually believe it. Mm. And this is where it becomes very dangerous for the people that are believing it, but also for the people that are, you know, spruiking the stuff as well.
Let me just mention one more story. He claims that he had memories of listening to this fantastic record that was produced to this old documentary in the 60s. You know, he had great childhood memories of it. And I can't remember, the documentary was about World War II, but it had this amazing soundtrack.
Hang on. How many World War II documentaries have got amazing soundtracks?
Well, apparently there was this one and he had the LP for it. He had the vinyl and he listened to it so much when he was a kid that it wore out and his parents had to buy him a new one. Now, years later, he had heard that the producer had reissued this soundtrack on CD and it'd been kind of remastered and re-released. So he picked up a copy. And as soon as he started playing this, he had that nostalgia from being a child. But at the same time, he claims he was transported to the USS Eldridge in a alternate timeline experience. And he experienced being in the Philadelphia experiment.
Oh, God.
And going back in time and stuff
God.
Like that. Just from playing this record, right? But the story doesn't end there. He was so convinced that this had triggered something real that he tracked down the original producer of this soundtrack because of all his connections with the major labels. It was produced by EMI, so he goes to the boss of EMI. He's like, hey, where's this guy that made this soundtrack?
Yeah, because I just let them into their office to talk to them.
So he tracked down the guy, turns up at this producer's house, and the producer's like out somewhere, but his wife answers the door and says, well, why don't you sit down? I'll make you a cup of tea and we could wait for my husband to come home.
Well, I call the police.
Yeah. So Preston's sitting there enjoying his cup of tea and the husband comes home, this producer who made this soundtrack. He walks in, and as soon as he walks in, he grasps his chest like he's having a heart attack and he's staring at Preston and he's going, oh, and he passes out. He falls over on the floor and passes out.
Mm-hmm.
When he comes to, Preston says, oh my God, are you okay? Is it something I did? I'm so sorry. Why did you pass out? What's wrong with you? And he said, it's you. It's you. And this producer claims that back in the 50s or whenever he recorded this soundtrack, on the day they were meant to record it with the orchestra, this other producer came in with this random guy and said, this guy's going to do the conducting. And he claims that this guy that did the conducting and made all these changes was Preston Nichols.
What?
He's like, you look exactly like him. It's you. It's you. It's you from 1957. I've got no doubt in my mind. It's you. So Preston's like, well, clearly this was evidence that I had written this music in the future. traveled back in time to the time of the original recording, made sure it was done properly, and then traveled back to my current time zone.
I am so pleased that you've done this book, because I have to be honest with you, and I know that when we spoke about the Montauk Project, it was more about not believing them. It was just talking about what the legend was and what the claims were. Mm. But I am convinced now more than ever that this guy is just out of his effing tree.
I don't know.
Like, just completely, just like gone.
He claims that he was the one that gave Jimi Hendrix the idea to use distortion pedals with his guitar. So.
Oh, come on. I mean, I can make all those claims. I could say that, you know, all the latest Lady Gaga songs have been written by me in the future when I travel to the past.
But do you have a love machine and a force field generator in your lab?
No, I don't actually. I am missing those.
There you go. So that is the story of Preston Nichols, as you know, compressed into a nutshell.
We read it for you, so you don't have to.
Compressed into a nutshell. I'll link to those two books in the show notes for you. That last one there was The Music of Time. And following on from this, we're going to delve into some more Sasquatch fashion stories after the break with John Keel's collection of stories based on Mothman, which has nothing to do with Mothman. That's coming up after this. Stay with us.
And girl, this don't have to mean nothing. This don't have to mean nothing. And girl, this don't have to mean
after that complete amount of weirdness, I want to bring us back to some seriousness, you know, some real investigation into glowing Sasquatch, basically.
That's amazing.
So today I have gone through the new release of The Book of Mothman, Everything You Want to Know About Reality Distortion But Were Afraid to Ask, by John A. Keel. It's edited by Andrew B. Colvin. And, you know, as I was going through this today, my opinions yet again of the paranormal have changed. And it was kind of funny how, like, I was reading this book and you were reading yours and we were talking. And I noticed that there was all these sort of connections that seemed to pop up. And the first thing that sort of came to my attention was Keel points out that, you know, there are all these reports that don't simply go back to, you know, the 1950s and 1960s. Then we had the contactee period. Mm. He says it goes back so much further. There is so much documented evidence of people having interactions with ETs, alien-like creatures, and monsters that go well back beyond, you know, the 1950s and the 1940s. Yep. I mean, we're talking about the late 1800s, where it opens with a case which is kind of interesting how the phenomena has changed. And I would have thought that if people were making this stuff up, it would be that it would line up with the current cultural ideas, you know, the popular culture. So it was like back when there was a belief that there were canals on Mars and there were alien species living there, you would think that if people are making it up, they'd start reporting that those descriptions were what they were interacting with.
Yeah, yeah.
But this woman from 1898 was living in Switzerland, and she claimed that at around 6:15 one morning, she found herself enveloped in an eerie reddish light. Now, she was awakened by this light and started suffering a series of strange experiences, one of which included that a mysterious Oriental gentleman suddenly appeared before her and started talking to her. There wasn't any of the abduction stuff. She didn't think it was that weird until he's like, come onto my starship.
Oh.
Come along for a ride.
Okay.
And then he ended up taking her off to this other planet. It doesn't give any details as to where it was, but she said that they were using peculiar vehicles that neither used wheels nor horses. Of course, it's 1898, so she wouldn't understand anti-gravity, you know.
Is this Asian Space Fabio from 1898?
No, I don't think it goes down that path, although it is kind of strange, right? This is the weird part, is that she claims that she had ongoing interactions with this guy until one day he abruptly stopped calling.
It's not you.
No.
It's got nothing to do with you being pregnant.
But she says that after he disappeared, she started being attended to by these 3-foot-tall, large-eyed, but with small-nosed sort of creatures that had large hands with unusually long fingers.
Right.
Now, the description of these, as I went through later on, it seems to be almost like a pre-grey archetype. You know, it's like they're not greys, but it's sort of moving along that sort of, you know, direction. So, I mean, she could have been making it up, but I find it odd that she claims that she's interacting with this Oriental gentleman when it was all kind of nice and fun and flowery, and then next second she's being harassed by these small entities. Now, where this book has absolutely nothing to do with Mothman, is, you know, apart from this one small chapter, is that it moves from discussing, you know, how far back these interactions go, to more explaining that the phenomena is so incredibly intrinsically linked into itself.
Yeah.
Like it falls back on top of itself, which is why we really can't get a grasp on it. But essentially, the reason why we are seeing different species, we've got the tall whites, we've got the greys, we've got the Dracos, the reptilians, it goes on and on and on, is because there is an ET turf war going on Earth.
Oh, so this backs up Preston's claims that there's 3 factions fighting for the turf on planet Earth?
Well, it goes well beyond 3, but this actually makes me think, I wonder, because this was published in 1969, I wonder if Preston is a fan of Keel's work and has just taken some of his ideas and obviously built upon them. So Keel says that tall blondes, for example, seem to show up in the Western United States, Argentina and Brazil. England has had sightings for many years of these strange beings with unusually high foreheads. Venezuela has baffling incidents involving tiny humanoids covered with hair. And, of course, the eastern states of the US, back in the 1800s, seemed to have these ongoing interactions with 5'6", dark-skinned Oriental types. But it's funny how the literature has kind of changed, because certainly in the last maybe 20 to 30 years, it just seems that it's just greys. It's greys everywhere. Maybe a few reptilians will pop up, but the more exotic type don't seem to pop up that frequently. So anyway, as I was going through this book, he was saying that there are these outbreaks of little men. And it's not little green men, but there are these basically 3-foot-tall beings that from the late 1800s well into the 1940s seemed to pop up in flaps, and people had these weird experiences with them. But in each case, they always seemed to fly in really crappy craft that would come crashing down, that they would have to climb out and repair, which is often where they would be seen. If anyone actually got close to one, they stank. They smelt something putrid. Which started me thinking, like, well, what else? What other creatures do we know absolutely stink? And also, in some cases, they utilized a technology which was this weird glowing yellow or green goop.
Okay.
But it was also like a beam, but sometimes creatures were covered in it. I'm thinking, this is all kind of lining up with Sasquatch stuff. And then that's where he goes next. Goes straight down the path of Sasquatch.
For me?
You're putting me off my game, Ben. So as I went through these stories today, I've actually pulled them out and I wanted to go into them. So he basically says that, okay, There's nothing to confirm this whatsoever, so we have to take this with a grain of salt. But there are unconfirmed reports from the mid to late 1500s into the 1700s where British explorers came upon a tribe of 8-foot-tall hairy men riding horses, wearing what appeared to be animal skins.
Oh, yes.
And possessing bows and arrows. Now, reports from the local inhabitants said that these entities were hostile and should never be approached. The weird thing was is that the British were told by the locals that these people or these Bigfoot-type creatures frequently entered and left the area utilizing what they called sky canoes or sky vehicles. So Keel's saying, you know, there's a lot of, you know, documented evidence that suggests, well, not documented evidence, but there are reports coming out that suggest that the UFO phenomena and Bigfoot is linked in some way.
Right.
And so he continues to provide examples of this. He says back in the 1930s, there was reports from Native Americans in Tennessee that they'd captured this unusual tall, hairy man that the tribe would feed regularly and he finally calmed down. But when people actually came to see this creature and investigators or researchers of the time actually went to speak to the Native Americans are like, well, they actually come and they steal our food and they mess with us and they throw things at us and they wreck up our camp. So we capture one of them. And then one of the researchers says to them, well, how do they get here? Where are they coming from? And they're like, no, they've frequently been coming here for generations. They come in these moons that appear over the valley and then they get ejected out.
Oh, wow.
Or they drop out and they go running off into the forest. It's like, this has been happening for generations. We see them all the time. So yet again, I mean, they're not saying that absolutely it's Bigfoot that's coming, but the creature and the description lines up very much with the class.
That's no moon.
I love these stories of Sasquatch being in spaceships, though. This is the most amazing subgenre of the paranormal.
Well, it really is, and it continues, because, I mean, I'm definitely saving the best for last. So let's get on to some more of the green goop kind of stuff. So back in the 1960s, there was a report of a couple who had basically stopped to park. You know, they were teenagers and they're doing what teenagers do. And they're in the car and they're making out and everything's going well until they hear this rumbling sound and the car starts sort of vibrating and you can see all the wind blowing up outside the car. So they look over into the distance and they can see that there's this craft approaching. At the time, from the distance, it's this bright white light, but it gets closer and closer and closer. And they can see that it is some type of saucer-shaped craft, you know, very, you know, shiny aluminium, you know, kind of special craft. Now, as they're sitting there dumbstruck, not knowing what to do, the craft descends on the beach, which wasn't too far away from them. And as it descends, it actually opens up a little porthole or whatever it is on the side of the craft and emits this beam, like a laser beam, but it was this glowing green color into the trees in the distance.
Yeah.
They look over to where this thing is being projected into. Out from the forest climbs a Sasquatch.
What?
So they don't actually see it actually climb out of the beam, but they do suggest that obviously the beam had something to do with bringing that. So who knows if it was teleporting this thing out or if it was maybe opening a dimension for it or whatever it was, but it doesn't end there. So they're gobsmacked. They don't know what to do and they're kind of like hiding and they're looking and they can see this thing sort of come walking past. And they think that it's gone past, but it's massive. It's 8 to 10 feet tall, covered in brown, black, shaggy hair. It's kind of shiny. It's got the red eye shine, but it looks away. And they think, oh, it's gone. Next second, it turns around and looks straight at the car. So again, in fear, it walks over to the car, puts its hands on top of the car, and starts rocking the car back and forth, not violently.
It's like, now kiss.
So the guy gets the car in gear, drives off, you know, screaming, very upset. They see the thing just sort of standing in the distance. It doesn't seem to be too concerned at all. They get to a police station, and where this was actually documented is that the police did register that there were scratch marks on the roof of the car on one side.
Right.
So something had caused the scratch marks, whether or not it was actually some summoned Bigfoot, we'll never know.
Whatever this thing was, according to the witnesses, beamed out from a UFO.
Yeah, exactly. So it was funny that beam was mentioned because it continues. So it goes back into, it was probably the late 1970s, and there was a guy who was at his farm, and he had heard that there was like this sort of ruckus going on outside. So he gets up, and he goes to his window, and as this ruckus is occurring, he can hear yet again like this rapping noise or a scratching noise to the side. So he's looking around, and he can't see anything out in the distance, but his animals are going absolutely crazy. Next second, Sasquatch pops up in the window.
What?
But he's wearing a coat and plaid pants.
What?
And it's like all ill-fitting, and it's like he's trying to like pull his way through, but it's like torn and scratched. So the guy screams, Bigfoot roars in his face, goes running off, and the worst part is that as he runs off, he damages the fence. And the guy's ticked off. And obviously, he's at a loss to understand what the hell just happened.
Maybe Bigfoot's upset because he put his favorite plaid pants in the dryer. And they shrank, and now he's got this ill-fitting costume he's got to
wear. Do you have this at a 32? But the weird thing was, where other corroborating evidence came through, was that a local who lived nearby, or a neighbour, had said that they had seen this creature drop out of some sort of weird craft.
Oh,
as it did, it was covered in a green glow, which it basically shook off.
Oh, so like a wet dog.
Yeah, just shook it off and then obviously went looking for clothes.
You see, it's amazing how these tales line up with what Kawani Lapsaridis has been saying for decades, that the Sasquatch are friends of the space people, that their origins are from the stars, they're not actually native to this planet. It also lines up with that insane channeling story we had from the woman who claimed that she was in touch with the Sasquatch in the forest.
Yeah.
And that the reason they were here is because their home planet was destroyed and the Space Brothers helped them come here because they had nowhere else to go.
You know what? I don't want to actually subscribe to that theory, because I think that if anything is going on, if Bigfoot actually exists, I really do think that it's probably just a lost species, or maybe it's, you know, some hominid that we're yet to discover, which is quite elusive. We discover new species all the time, so it's possible.
But I mean, if they were getting around in flying saucers, that would be a good explanation for why they're so elusive.
Well, exactly, and it would explain why we don't have any bodies, because obviously they must be beaming them up or whatever they're doing. And see, that continues as well. And it's kind of great how Keel and, you know, other reports just seem to sort of, they gel together, and you've got to draw your own dots. But, you know, like, it kind of allows you to justify it a little bit.
I also wonder, I have to throw this in there, of how often Keel makes them gel himself.
Yeah, you know, right.
Like the report.
Well, that's what I'm saying, you know, with this. Let's take it with a grain of salt.
How much has Keel modified the report to fit, you know, his point of view?
Well, that's a very valid point. And I've noticed that Keel's point of view actually changes. Like, after all the reports I've read, it changes over and over. But he does seem to have these core beliefs which don't change. And I think that's important. I think some of us, you know, when you're trying to string together an argument on topics like this, you kind of have to have your core belief about them. And then, yeah, you can have, you know, new information come through which allows you to waver. Just got to sort of go, oh, maybe there's more elements to this than we actually understood. And now going on to these interactions with Sasquatch in cars, he actually links it to the fact that not only do we have these weird UFO reports, but it seems that Sasquatch is also involved in electrical disturbances, which links back to when people encounter UFOs.
Right.
So there's reports from the 1980s where someone was driving along the road and minding their own business, but they're on a road trip. And as they're driving along, this was in the US, they noticed that there was a tall man in the distance standing on the side of the road. They thought that it was a hobo or a hitchhiker or something, because he was just ragged. It was just not normal. As they get closer, they see that it is this tall Bigfoot-type creature, but ape-like, yet it still had a human-like face and human-like hands. So, I mean, it fits in with the phenomena. What happened was, though, is that Bigfoot starts running along the side of the car. And obviously they don't want to stop. So as Bigfoot's running along, Bigfoot almost kind of stumbles and falls. So he's a bit of a klutz. Like, he falls down.
We know that, yeah.
But as that happens, their car engine starts sparking and all the electricals in the car start steaming and smoking.
Uh-huh.
And all of the, like, the smell of ozone was going through the car. And essentially it destroyed all the electrics in their car. They're terrified. They've gotten further down the road so that they can be away. They've got some distance from this creature. They actually look back to see this creature. All he does is almost like standing there like, that's what you get for not picking me up. And he almost, they say he melted back into the forest.
Oh, wow.
So it was like the shimmering effect, and then he kind of just disappeared.
Call AAA.
So the highlight of these stories today, as I was going through, and this I find honestly very difficult to believe, but because we took, you know, a more lighthearted sort of fun approach on this show, I have to mention this. This really, I don't know. Let me just explain it. There was a group of farmers that had gotten up at 4:30 in the morning, which is pretty typical to get up and make sure that you're attending to the farm.
That checks out. Farmers up at 4:30 a.m. So far, the story checks out.
They're up with a cock. So they're out there and they hear this rumbling coming over in the distance. And as they look up into the sky, they can see that something's approaching. But it's not a typical classical UFO or anything. It's like this weird light that as the light sort of subsides, it's this weird steampunk style like craft.
Oh, wow.
So this thing...
So it's like... it's like a steam engine coming at them.
Chitty chitty bang bang or something. And as it comes along, this actually, you know what? It actually does light up very well with chitty chitty bang bang because as it comes along, it lands. These guys aren't running, but they're still trying to get their head around what's going on here. And they knew that, you know, aerial craft existed, so it wasn't that weird, but they didn't realize that this was a UFO. The door opens, and from it descends a Sasquatch. It's the only way I can describe it. It's this tall, upright, standing, very proud Sasquatch. He comes out, he puts his arms out.
Yeah.
And starts singing.
What?
But it's not like, it's more like this. And he's doing this, and it was almost like they thought, is he trying to communicate? What's this guy doing? So they kind of like, you go, you go. So they get the youngest one to go and walk up to this guy. He walks up to Sasquatch. Sasquatch kicks him. Like, makes him, like, basically does his butterfly kick.
Why?
And, like, kicks him hard.
Why?
The guy goes flying, breaks his hip. Sasquatch just turns around, gets back into the craft. The craft ascends and just disappears.
What the fuck?
And I'm like, that's it.
Like, I like how the ship is really shitty as well. Like, Sasquatch just put it together from scrapyard parts and it's barely working.
It's like his tour bus.
And he stops for an impromptu opera session.
So I'm just like,
I get to see him go, la 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 la.
So, look, I don't know. I mean, I've pulled this out of this. I've looked through the internet today. I've tried to find reports which line up. And honestly, all I have found is just a mad menagerie of Bigfoot. But yet again, we have more evidence to suggest that Bigfoot is a bumbling klutz.
It's amazing that in that story, it really sounded like Sasquatch was from another planet and was announcing themselves to the humans and was openly inviting conversation and diplomacy with said farmers. And then just drop kicks the first one that comes at him. Bigfoot needs to step up his xenophobic tendencies. It's a bit ridiculous. How does he expect to get around in the Galactic Federation if he's drop-kicking every alien species he sees?
Look, and so a lot of this I've also pulled from very, very obscure forums. So, look, again, take all of this with a grain of salt. I just don't know, but I will link to the book of Mothman. There's actually plenty more reports and crazy stuff in there that I might cover in the future because there's other things about people being harassed by men in black, but also there's this weird stuff about... Well, before the Men in Black, there were these people known as the malicious traveling salesmen. So there's like before Men in Black became popular, there were people that were being harassed by what they called traveling salesmen. But it lines up very in a very similar fashion to the Men in Black and the reports from the 1950s and 60s. So cool, very, very cool stuff. And I'll link to it in the show notes at Mysterious Universe.
John Keel, huh?
Yeah.
Still pumping out the hits.
Well, he's dead, isn't he?
Post-mortem.
Right, I'm sure he was dead.
We've got a couple of stories to finish off this show with. First up in the news, man in Madrid survives being struck by lightning in the scrotum. Next story, we head to news.com.au.
At least point out he survived.
He's fine.
All right, he's
not going to have kids.
Well, he just had his implant turned on.
Man's girlfriend and ex-partner jump into the river to see who he'll rescue.
This is the most ridiculous. This goes to show you that I have no faith in humanity anymore. It's gone.
Wu Xia, 21, had broken up with long-term girlfriend Jun Tang, who was 20, after meeting new love Rong Sao, 22, in Ningbo City in East China's Zhejiang province. But over the following 3 months, jilted Jun kept hassling him to get back with her and pressuring Rong to leave him. Eventually, Wu decided to arrange a meeting between the three of them at a nearby park next to a river. First of all, if you're...
You never get your ex back with your current partner. That's stupid.
If you're trapped in a love triangle... Don't get together for a chat.
Yeah. This is why you're on Plus. So it's sound advice, never get them together.
Exactly. There's quotes from Wu who said, I was sick of being nagged from both sides. Rong was moaning about Jun and Jun was moaning about her and it all got too much. He said, I became confused about who I wanted to be with, so I thought it would be best if we all met and talked about it.
Do you know what? I would have had more, you know, respect for these girls if they both just pushed him in the river.
Well, here's what happened. His ex, Jun, turns up, and she's pretty upset. And then his current girlfriend, Rong, turns up. She's very upset. They're standing on this bridge next to the river. And then Woo turns up and says, let's talk about it. And then immediately his ex hurls herself into the river.
Oh.
She's just had enough. Like, she's like, I've had enough.
Oh, but that's also attention seeking as well, right?
Then his current girlfriend is like, I'm not letting this bitch get a one-up on me. She throws herself into the river as well and says, you have to decide, choose between us.
You know what? That's actually an effective way of getting someone to make a decision. I can see it.
So Woo, of course, drags in his current girlfriend, calls his brother.
Hang on. This other chick is drowning and he calls his brother.
I don't know if she's drowning, but I wouldn't want to stay too long in a Chinese river, put it that way.
Right.
His brother comes and rescues
The ex.
Yeah. And he goes home with his current girlfriend, Rong. And when questioned by the press, he said, I was put in a difficult situation and I had to make a choice between right and wrong. I chose wrong.
That's awful.
His girlfriend's name is Rong. Get it?
Oh,
true story.
Ching. That's a terrible. What has been with this casual racism on this show? It's awful.
No one's being racist, man.
I had to choose between right and wrong, and I chose wrong.
We're just reporting the story. We're just reporting the story. Let's go to relationship expert Jay-Z for a quote.
If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. I got the rat patrol on the cat patrol.
Sound advice, apparently.
Well said, yeah. Jay-Z. Well said indeed.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. You said to me today, have you ever had a peacock problem? And you'd be surprised, but I actually have had a peacock problem.
So right at the end of the day, I saw this thread pop up in Ask Reddit, and I just thought this was the most ridiculous random question that I've ever seen in that subreddit, but bizarrely, it was getting thousands and thousands of comments. Redditors with peacocks. What is the worst / most interesting thing you have ever had happen? So, yeah, like, who owns a peacock that has a story to report?
Oh, no, they're really popular, and they're mongrel bastard things. Like, when I was a kid in the 90s, there was a zoo that was down the road from us, you know, maybe a couple of miles or so, and it was a privately owned zoo, and obviously, you know, it didn't do well, so it shut down. And rather than actually relocating the animals, what they did is they just opened all the cages. So there wasn't anything too exotic, but there was a flock of peacocks. And when I mean a flock, they turn into this ravenous cult of peacocks, which descended upon our homes. And I'm not kidding. All throughout the 90s, it was these damn peacocks that would like come and attack us, and they'd be like making terrible noises at night.
They're really loud.
Tapping
right?
on the windows at night. So I was freaked out as a kid, they were just really aggressive.
See, this is more evidence that your home state is full of hicks. Like, who just opens up a zoo and says, okay, well, what are we going to do with these animals? We can't responsibly take care of them, so let's just unleash them on society.
Oh, who knows with that bloody place.
So it amazes me that you had a peacock story, but going through this thread,
a lot of people have got peacock stories.
Thousands of people have peacock stories. One of the top comments was, we have a neighborhood wandering peacock. It is a complete asshole and chases the friendly fixed feral, and on occasion will block traffic by puffing up and screaming. Complete dickhead. Next one. I worked at a water park that had them. One attacked a lady on her Scooty Puff.
Yeah, Scooty Puff Jr.
A Scooty Puff?
They're like little, like, yeah, mobility scooters.
So, this giant peacock's attacking this lady on a Scooter Puff, but the scooter could nowhere near outrun the peacock.
No, they can't.
He says, imagine seeing this huge lady screaming her head off like a banshee while this glorious bird chases her down the sidewalk, pecking at her and her Scooty Puff the entire time.
It's terrifyingly beautiful.
It was hilarious. And my favorite one has all these upvotes from Duckspunk, who said, okay, in all honesty, when I was a teenager, I stole a peacock from a meth lab.
What?
Afterwards, that peacock was very clingy, but in a weird way. He wouldn't let most people approach him, but he would try to not let me out of his sight. He even slept outside my bedroom window at night, and eventually we had to get rid of him because he was raping the chickens and they stopped laying eggs out of fear.
What the hell?
So the entire list of questions after that is, you got to peacock from a meth lab?
Yeah, I mean, do you want to explain that first before you go on to why peacocks are dicks?
So we will link to this in the show notes, and I think it does confirm that, as in your experience, peacocks are complete dickheads.
They are. The prettier they are, the often more of a dickhead they are. Yeah. It's obvious.
And there will be one final thread we'll link to, because occasionally Ask Reddit has some really great threads that get a lot of responses, and you can find great stories in there. There was a great one, and these pop up all the time. They're very common. The latest was, what's the creepiest and or most unexplainable thing that has ever happened to you or someone you know? And this is where we had a totally lame time slip.
Oh, God, I forgot about that. I thought we got away with that.
So one of the top comments was, this lady said she got up in the morning, she stepped into the shower, and she's applying the shampoo. She's shampooing her hair. And the next minute, she's in her bedroom with the towel wrapped around her wet hair. And she's like, what just happened?
That's not a time slip. That's a stroke.
That's a time slip.
That's a totally lame time slip.
It's a totally lame time slip. So I wouldn't mind experiencing that time slip, even if it's just mundane chores that I'm skipping over. Who cares?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, but as I said, you know, at the start of the show, there's other things that you don't want to skip over. You know, I don't want to skip over having sex. I don't want to be like sitting in bed the next second, I've got a cigarette in my mouth.
Yeah,
you know, not good.
There's other stories of strange floating orbs.
Not that I smoke.
What?
Not that I smoke. I just realised that would be a weird time slip.
That would be weird. There's heaps of UFO sightings in there. There's a strange case of phantoms, spiders.
Yeah, I actually read that one. I wanted to mention that. So there was a woman who claims that she looked down onto the table and she saw the most hideous spider that you could possibly imagine. It was so unusual that it went beyond just the normal phobia of spiders, and she was screaming out about it. Apparently a family member looked over to where it was, and she's like, there's nothing there. So it was kind of strange, but I'm like, is that just like some type of hallucination? Is she taking something and it's not responding well? So yeah, it's interesting though how those sort of things just pop up over and over in the thread.
Yeah, it's often the best stories here. The people who leave the comments will say, look, I left this in a thread from, you know, 2 years ago, and I'll just repost the same comment. So you get some of the same stories popping up again. But then occasionally you just have amazing crappy time slips that just come out of nowhere. And just make your day. We'll link to those threads in the show notes, of course, mysteriousuniverse.org. Thank you so much for being on Plus. We had a lot of fun on this episode. We'll return to a more balanced investigation / glowing Bigfoot combination on the next episode. We'll see you on Thursday.